All right, get ready because we're diving deep into the brain today, exploring those brain disorders and diseases, how memory works, and how we perceive the world.
A journey into the physical brain and the mind, how they work together.
Let's start with some definitions. Brain disorders versus brain diseases. Is there even a difference?
Think of disorders as impacting how we think and feel, the psychology. Diseases are more about the brain's structure and function.
The neurology.
Yeah, neurology.
So Alzheimer's would be a good example of where it gets blurry, since both the mind and the brain are involved.
Exactly. It shows the connection. Now, where do these brain disorders and diseases come from? It's a mix, genetics, lifestyle choices.
Things we can control.
Right. And also environmental factors. And then there's traumatic brain injuries, which are often unavoidable accidents.
And the impact can be huge, right? Affecting memory, speech, even development?
Absolutely. Some of the most fundamental things that make us human.
Like autism spectrum disorder, or ASD, a developmental disorder affecting 1 in 54 children. More common in boys, we still don't know why. It impacts communication, behavior, social interaction, and epigenetics might be involved. Can you explain that?
Epigenetics. Think of it like this. What we experience can switch certain genes on or off. It might influence things like ASD.
So it's not just our DNA, it's also what happens to us.
Right, that complex mix of nature and nurture. Now let's look at the brains of people with ASD. We see some interesting differences in something called neuronal pruning.
Pruning? Like a tree?
Sort of. Some have over-pruning, meaning fewer connections, which we call hypoconnectivity.
Okay, so less connections between neurons.
Right. Others have under-pruning, leading to too many connections. That's hyperconnectivity.
So like a busy highway versus a quiet country road.
Yeah, that's a great way to visualize it. And hyperconnectivity, it's not always a good thing.
Wait, more connections isn't better? I thought more connections were always a good thing.
It can be both. Hyperconnectivity might lead to things like enhanced memory, intelligence.
Really?
Even creativity. But it's also linked to a higher risk of epilepsy, intense focus, kind of like OCD, and heightened stress, anxiety.
Sensory overload too, right?
Exactly.
So it's a balance. More isn't always better. But for someone with ASD who has this hyperconnectivity, what does that actually look like in their lives?
Imagine a child with ASD in a classroom. They might be able to memorize facts quickly and perfectly, but then struggle with the noise, the chaos, the environment. Things others barely notice become overwhelming.
Makes sense. So that's hyperconnectivity. Now let's talk about Alzheimer's disease. It's mostly driven by genetics, right?
Genetics play a big role, yes. And it's progressive. Gets worse over time. Leads to brain atrophy.
Brain atrophy? What does that even mean?
The brain shrinks.
Yeah.
And neurons start to die off.
Neurons. Those brain messengers. So how do they actually die in Alzheimer's?
Think of a city with roads connecting everything, allowing for communication, transportation. In Alzheimer's, a protein called tau builds up inside those roads.
Blocking traffic.
Yes. Essential supplies can't reach their destination. Eventually, those areas shut down.
So it's like the communication network breaks down, leading to the memory loss we see in AD.
Exactly. And it happens in stages, mild, moderate, and severe, each stage with more cognitive impairment.
So what do those stages actually look like? What kinds of changes would someone experience?
Mild stage, they might forget recent conversations, misplace things.
Things we all do sometimes, right?
Yeah, but more frequently. Moderate stage, they might wander, get lost, even in familiar places. Struggle to remember names of loved ones.
Oh, wow. That's tough.
And the severe stage, loss of ability to walk, talk, even control basic bodily functions.
Heartbreaking. Okay, let's move on to traumatic brain injuries, or TBIs. Concussions, anoxia, penetrating injuries.
Each type has its own challenges.
Penetrating injuries sound the most serious. What are those, exactly?
When an object goes through the skull and into the brain, damage to the brain tissue itself. Car accidents, gunshot wounds, or even a really bad blow to the head.
So the damage is focused right where the object entered the brain?
Yes, and the severity depends on where and how much damage there is. It can range from mild cognitive problems to life-altering disabilities.
Let's lighten things up a bit. Let's talk about cognitive control. That ability to keep our thoughts and emotions, our actions, in check.
Like the captain of our mental ship. Steering us toward our goals, helping us resist distractions.
Right, don't eat all the chips, or finish the report before social media, that kind of thing.
Exactly. Consciously overriding those impulses.
So what's happening in our brains when we do that? Which parts are working hard?
The prefrontal cortex, or PFC, is key here. The brain's control center. Planning, decisions, regulating behavior. Strong PFC, better control. weaker PFC, harder to resist those temptations.
So someone with a weaker PFC might struggle with things like procrastination or impulsive decisions.
Right. But it's not just willpower either. We also have a habit system. Works mostly on autopilot.
A habit system. Tell me more about that.
Think about brushing your teeth, driving to work, tying your shoes.
Yeah, I do those without even thinking.
Exactly. Habits. Governed by the basal ganglia. Deep in the brain.
So our brains create these shortcuts to make life easier.
Exactly. Frees up resources for more complex stuff.
Like autopilot. Makes sense. But what about when emotions get intense? It feels like all that control just vanishes.
Good point. Emotions can hijack our control system.
Like a pirate takeover.
Uh-huh. Kind of. The amygdala is the culprit here. The brain's alarm system. Always looking for threats. Triggers that fight or flight response.
So when we're super stressed, anxious, the amygdala takes over. Rational thinking goes out the window.
That's the amygdala hijack. Survival mode kicks in.
Give us an example. How would that actually happen?
Imagine someone cuts you off while driving. Amygdala sees a threat. Adrenaline, cortisol, all of that.
Heart racing, palms sweating.
Exactly. You might yell, make a gesture. Your PFC, which would normally keep you calm, is offline.
So the emotional brain wins in those moments. And we maybe do things we regret later.
Right. Understanding this interplay is key to managing emotions, strengthening our control. Now, what makes humans so good at language?
It's incredible, right? We can communicate such complex ideas.
A big part of it is a gene called FOXP2. Plays a crucial role in producing and understanding language.
And we can even decipher jumbled language. Have you ever heard of typoglycemia?
Where you can read a sentence even if the letters in the middle of words are mixed up.
As long as the first and last letters are correct. Exactly.
Oh, amazing, right? Our brains fill in the gaps. Using context and patterns, top-down processing.
Right. Speaking of language challenges, dyslexia. Impacts reading and spelling, but doesn't affect intelligence overall.
People with dyslexia struggle with breaking down words into individual sounds, phonological processing. So decoding written words is tough.
Makes reading fluency, comprehension more challenging.
Right. And brain imaging shows they rely more on the right hemisphere for language.
Interesting. Most people use the left hemisphere, right?
Exactly. This might be why some with dyslexia excel in spatial reasoning, creativity, big picture thinking.
So it's not a lack of intelligence, but a different way of processing language. Fascinating. Let's talk about the two main language areas in the brain, Broca's and Wernicke's.
Broca's in the frontal lobe is all about speech production. Wernicke's in the temporal lobe is for understanding spoken language.
Production and comprehension. Damage to there would cause serious problems, I imagine.
Definitely. Damage to Broca's, someone might understand what they want to say, but struggle to form the words. Wernicke's damage, they might speak fluently, but the words don't make sense.
Wow, that's a stark difference. Now, what about this idea that the language we speak actually shapes how we think? The Sapir-Whorf hypothesis.
It suggests that language structure influences a speaker's worldview and cognition. Like, language is a lens through which we see and understand the world.
Can you give us an example?
The Himba tribe in Namibia. Their language doesn't have separate words for blue and green. And studies show they have trouble distinguishing between those colors, so language may shape their color perception.
That's incredible. Like, their language is creating a different reality.
There's debate about how much language shapes thought, but it's a fascinating area. Language both reflects and influences our cognitive processes.
So learning a new language could actually rewire our brains, expand our ways of thinking.
Potentially, yes. And on that note, there's the bilingual advantage hypothesis.
I've heard that being bilingual is good for your brain. Is that true?
Research suggests it can enhance cognitive abilities, better memory, attention control, maybe even a delay in cognitive decline.
Amazing. Why would that be?
Think of it like a workout. Bilingual people constantly switch between languages. Strengthens their executive control system, improves focus, multitasking, inhibiting distractions.
Sounds like a cognitive superpower. I need to start learning a new language.
Never too late. Now let's have some fun with language. Ever mishear song lyrics?
Oh yeah, all the time. Makes up my own versions.
Those are Mondegreens.
Right. Like I thought the lyrics to We Built This City were We Built This City on sausage rolls.
Hilarious, right? Shows how our brains try to make sense of sounds, even when they're unclear.
Always looking for patterns, filling in the gaps, sometimes with funny results.
Exactly. Perception is an active process. Our brains constantly construct our reality.
Sometimes with some interesting detours. Speaking of challenging our brains, tongue twisters.
Great example. A workout for your mouth and brain.
Try saying, she sells seashells by the seashore fast.
See? Not easy. It tests articulation, auditory feedback, motor control.
So much brain power for such silly sounds.
It highlights how interconnected our brains are. Language is one of the most complex human abilities. Requires a symphony of brain regions working together.
All right, let's talk about human development. That journey from tiny babies to adults always brings up that nature versus nurture debate. Genes or environment? What shapes us?
A big question, right? And the answer, like with most things in the brain, is both. Genes provide the potential.
The blueprint.
Yeah, like a blueprint. But our experiences, the interactions, that's what molds us.
So genes are the ingredients and environment's the chef.
Love that analogy. It's that interplay. And that's where epigenetics comes in.
The bridge between nature and nurture.
Exactly. Explains how things in our environment can switch genes on or off.
No way. Without changing the DNA itself.
Right. Take that FOXP2 gene. Essential for language, right?
Right.
But which languages a child learns and when depends on their environment. Makes me think of Genie.
That tragic case of isolation, deprived of language for years.
Really highlights the critical period hypothesis. A crucial window, usually before age 5, for optimal language learning.
Because the brain is so adaptable then.
Super plastic, forming new connections fast. If a child misses that language exposure, it can have lasting effects.
So those early years are crucial.
They are. Even the terrible twos, all that chaos, important for brain development.
Tantrums and all.
Think of it as tons of growth, exploration, synapses forming like crazy. Then pruning happens.
Pruning, like with a tree.
Kind of. The brain refines those connections. Based on experience.
So those meltdowns are about more than just testing limits. It's the brain figuring things out. But how do researchers even study these changes in babies? They can't exactly tell us what they're thinking.
Right. Can't fill out surveys. So we use things like preferential looking studies. Track where they look, for how long.
Babies stare at what interests them, right?
Exactly. Longer gaze means more novelty, more engagement. Helps us understand their cognitive processes. Speaking of which, we can't forget Piaget's stages of development.
Those four stages, sensorimotor and so on.
Yes. Gives us a framework for how kids' thinking changes over time. Sensorimotor, first stage, birth to 2 years old. Exploring the world through senses, actions. Developing object permanence.
Knowing things exist even when they're hidden.
Right. Peekaboo isn't so magical anymore. Then, pre-operational stage, 2 to 7 years old, imagination explodes.
Pretend play.
Exactly. Symbolic thinking emerges. But they're still egocentric, struggle to see things from another person's point of view.
Like if you're behind a curtain, they think you're gone.
Because if they can't see you, you can't see them. Then, concrete operational, 7 to 11 years old, more logical, organized thinking. Conservation develops.
Understanding that changing how something looks doesn't change its amount.
Exactly, like pouring liquid between different shaped glasses. Finally, formal operational. 11 years and up. Abstract thinking kicks in.
Hypothetical situations, big ideas.
Right. Moral reasoning, philosophy, all of that becomes accessible. It's incredible how much cognitive growth happens. Makes you wonder if our perception of the world changes as we develop, too.
Definitely makes you think. And that brings us to perception, how we transform all that sensory input into experiences. We've talked about how our senses can trick us with those illusions. Do you think our senses actually stop us from seeing reality as it truly is?
That's a deep one. Philosophers have debated this for centuries. Our senses provide the data, but our brains interpret it.
So it's our brains that create our reality.
In a way, yes. Our experience is subjective, shaped by our individual brains and what we've been through.
Wow. So maybe there's not one true reality. We each have our own versions.
Interesting to think about, right? Let's look at some specifics, starting with vision. The human eye is amazing, but it doesn't work like a camera. It doesn't capture a perfect image all at once.
So how does it work?
Our eyes are always moving, little jumps called saccades, gathering bits of information. Mm. Then our brains stitch it all together.
Like editing a movie. Creating a seamless flow.
Exactly. And within the eye, we have rods and cones.
Those photoreceptor cells.
Yep. Rods are for dim light, but no color. Cones work in bright light, and they handle color.
So rods let us see stars at night, and cones give us those beautiful sunsets.
You got it. Now, how about color vision? Two main theories. Trichromatic theory and opponent process theory. Trichromatic says we have three types of cones for red, green, and blue light.
Like mixing primary colors.
Sort of. Our brains mix the light signals to create all the colors we see. Opponent process theory is about opposing pairs of colors. Red, green, blue, yellow, black, white.
Explains things like after images.
Right, exactly. Stare at a red image, then look at a white wall. You'll see green.
So cool. Like a mini optical illusion made by our own eyes. Now, what about depth perception? How do we see in 3D when our retinas only get 2D images?
Our brains are clever. They use binocular and monocular cues. Binocular cues use info from both eyes, like retinal disparity.
The difference between what each eye sees.
Right. Bigger difference, object seems closer. We also have convergence. Eyes turning inward when we focus on something close.
Like when you focus on your finger, move it closer and further.
Exactly. Your eyes converge to track it. Then there are monocular cues, which work with just one eye.
Things like relative size. Smaller things look farther away.
Yep. And occlusion. Objects blocking others must be closer. Linear perspective, those parallel lines seeming to meet in the distance.
So our brains combine all of that to make a 3D world from flat images. That's impressive. But with so much visual input all the time, how do we focus on what's important?
That's where selective attention comes in. Ability to focus on some things, ignore others, like a conversation at a noisy party.
A mental spotlight.
Perfect. But this spotlight can also make us miss things. Inattentional blindness.
Like that gorilla experiment where people miss something obvious because they're focused on something else.
Exactly. Shows how powerful attention is. This has been a fantastic journey, hasn't it? We've covered so much.
From brain disorders to how our brains develop to how we perceive the world around us. It really makes you appreciate the brain's power.
And how much we still have to learn. There's always more to explore.
So keep those neurons firing, everyone. Stay curious, keep learning, and we'll see you next time for another deep dive into the amazing world of the brain.